of November 13th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 126, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know, I was going to say, Michael, that in Los Angeles downtown, waiting in line to see the Twilight premiere for 7 days, like some of those weirdo fans.
Are they out there already? Yeah.
Yeah, they've been out there for 5 days. It's not Occupy Wall Street. It's like Occupy Twilight or something.
Well, I wouldn't call them weirdo fans. They love the franchise. It's important to them. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I guess they keep us in business. So, you know, why am I complaining? Now, speaking of business, we should probably get some business out of the way up front. You know, you can email us. Our email address, if you want to contact us, is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can always subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
And you can rate us on iTunes as well.
That's right. You can rate us on iTunes. You can review us on iTunes and even the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher.com. And I guess really, you know, we'll take care of the rest of the business at the end of the show, but we always leave all of that information at the closing of the show. We figured we'd move it up front. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the Oscars. Now, I'm loath to talk about the Oscars until the nominations are announced, because I just think there are already too many people and media outlets prognosticating on who's going to be nominated and who's going to be forgotten.
I bet The Artist gets nominated for Best Picture.
I bet you're right about that. That's a great film. You know, it turns out that the drama behind this year's awards telecast may be more interesting than the show itself. We probably don't have to tell you why at this point, but we will anyway. Ashton Kutcher, a.k.a. the king of Twitter, may be tempering his use of the social network after last week. We've got some theater news that Michael threw in at the last minute just to keep me on my toes, and we've squeezed more music news than you'll probably want to hear into Inside Baseball. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and end with some correspondence from listeners. No, we won't. We will not be ending with correspondence from listeners because there were no really interesting emails this week, or voicemails, for that matter. But first, as always, we will turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. This war film was so great. I felt like you were actually a part of the soldiers fighting the battle. That's how immersive and exciting this film was. It was unbelievable. You felt like you were right there with them, firing and shooting and risking your life. I mean, it was just so intense. It was great.
Well, Michael, I'm pretty sure that you were right there with them because it's a video game.
Technically, I guess you're right, but it felt like a film.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, it was released, last Tuesday and has sold 6.5 million copies only in the United States and the United Kingdom and only in 24 hours. That's $400 million in 24 hours, beating out the last Call of Duty release, which made $360 million.
It's a good day at the box office.
You know, but they're always saying, well, wait, I guess it wouldn't be the box office so much as the checkout.
Oh, the cash register, yeah.
The cash register. Yeah, you know, every time they release one of these video games now, these big, giant video
franchises,
games.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always seems like they come back and say, you know, it was the biggest entertainment opening of all time.
Well, $400 million in one day is a lot.
Yeah, I guess for video games, remember, it's $60 per game.
But dude, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess that doesn't matter when you think about it. Harry Potter made $160 million, the last Harry Potter film, which was a huge opening.
Yeah.
But as far as movies go, what came in first?
Well, the number one movie around the world at the box office was The Immortals, the Tarsem Singh spectacle. It grossed $69 million worldwide. It was a good debut for Relativity Media, which was had fully funded the film itself. So it's a solid success all around the world. Not quite the size of 300, which opened to more than that in the U.S. alone, but it's a very strong debut.
And many people could say that's a video game in and of itself. It's just that you don't exactly control it.
Number two around the world is Puss in Boots, which grossed another $30 million worldwide, mostly in the U.S. It's just in four markets overseas so far. It's grossed $157 million worldwide and counting. There's a lot more to come. And number three worldwide is the Adam Sandler film Jack and Jill. It grossed $28.7 million worldwide. And just a few million dollars of that comes from overseas. But keep in mind, five of the last seven Adam Sandler comedies have grossed more than $100 million overseas. So he's one of those rare U.S. comedians that is a big draw around the world. At number four around the world is The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. It grossed $26.7 million worldwide. It's at $159 million and counting.
And of still course, has yet to open in the United States.
Right. In North America, it opens December 21st, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Number five is Tower Heist, the Brett Ratner, Eddie Murphy comedy where they take solace and refuge after leaving the Oscars. It grossed $20.8 million worldwide. It's at $64 million and counting. At number six, this I think is fascinating, is Intouchables, a French comedy that we talked about last week. And it opened at number one in the box office in France last week, grossing $12.5 million. This weekend, it increased its box office take to $18 million. It increased almost 50% at the box office after opening at number one to huge numbers. It's a comedy about a millionaire quadriplegic and his ex-con immigrant caregiver, which sounds incredibly broad.
Obviously a remake from an American
a remake
movie.
Will be in the works. The Weinsteins own the U.S. rights to this film. I assume they bought the English language remake rights, or I will fall over dead in shock if they didn't. But, I mean, that's just unbelievable. It's grossed $30 million in France alone. Increasing your box office 50% when you had such a big opening, that is just mind-blowing. So this is a movie I'm very interested to see. At number seven worldwide is Real Steel, the Hugh Jackman warm family action film with boxing robots. It grossed $14 million worldwide. It's at $228 million and counting. Not great. He's doing much better on Broadway, where he opened to rave reviews last week, where people compared him to Liza Minnelli, Sammy Davis Jr., and Frank Sinatra all rolled up into one.
Now, I saw that on Twitter. You saw Hugh Jackman and said there's just no resisting him. He is a huge hit.
Yes, I did not rave like the other people. I gave it 3 stars out of 4. It was very fun. He's a real entertainer. He comes out, and there's nothing to compare him to except those old showbiz veterans like Sammy and Liza. Not that he's at their level vocally, but he's just a charmer, man. He comes out on stage, he's chatting, he's talking, he jokes with the audience, he sings, he dances. He did much better when he was doing individual songs as opposed to medleys, because he's not a great vocalist, and he really needs to be able to dig into a song and a character to make it work. So when he's doing a medley of songs about dancing, for example, it's fine. It's pleasant. You enjoy yourself, but it's not great the way Sinatra or Liza or somebody might do. It's just pleasant. But when he did some really good solo numbers like Soliloquy from Carousel, and he was charming as all get out. Totally worth the money. The audience was eating out of his hand from the second he arrived. He could play there for 10 months, and it's only a 10-week run, but he could stay there as long as he wants. At number eight is In Time, the Justin Timberlake movie. It grossed $12.5 million worldwide. It's at $84 million and counting. And number nine was a movie that perhaps thought it was an Oscar hopeful, but probably isn't. It's J. Edgar, directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Leonardo DiCaprio. It grossed $11.4 million worldwide, basically North America. And everyone I know and all the reviews I read basically said, meh.
Yeah, I mean, I was really shocked at how many people said the movie's unwatchable. Now, I don't think that's true. But so many people were they hated this movie. So many critics.
Well, some people I know thought there were some interesting elements to it. It wasn't totally, nobody thought it was good. But some people thought there was a few interesting things. But even like the core target audience, like middle-aged theater goers, sort of Oscar type profile type people, they were sort of like, it was okay.
You know, right.
That seemed to be about the strongest endorsement it got. And number 10 worldwide is Paranormal Activity 3, which grossed another $10.7 million. It's at $189 million worldwide. There will be a Paranormal Activity 4, 5, and presumably 6.
Yes.
And at number 11, this is in the U.S. only, A Very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas. It grossed another $5.9 million. It's at $23 million worldwide and counting.
Now, here in the United States, of course, Immortals topped the box office with $32 million, but then Jack and
Just
Jill—
Just like it did around the world.
Right, and Jack and Jill came in second, which really surprised me since it literally, that film, the Adam Sandler movie, got like a 3% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, it would have surprised me if it didn't. I saw box office profits and some others predicting a lower than $20 million opening. That's just he's always doing mid-20s to 30s or 40s. I mean, mid-20s is low for him. So you've just got to expect him to keep doing what he's doing until people stop going. You know, so I thought those estimates were low. Yeah, it got bad reviews, but his fans don't care. This is the most critic-proof and the least critic-important movie imaginable. It looks awful, but,
it looks horrible.
What do they care?
I saw over the weekend, well, first, I guess we should say $25 million. Three films did over $25 million. So the box office is 12% up for the same
waking
period.
Up.
Yeah, it's waking up. I, instead of going to see J. Edgar, because I was going to see that over the weekend, I got such horrible reviews and such horrible word of mouth. I actually saw on video on demand, even though I probably should have gone to the theater since it was playing in my neighborhood. I went to see a movie called Margin Call.
Oh, and, yes, I've heard very good things about this. This is a drama about Wall Street.
Yes, and it's fantastic. It's like Glengarry Glen Ross. It could have been a play. Every performance is great. Every actor gets their own moment.
Who's the lead?
Well, that's the thing. It's an ensemble.
Ah, I thought it was Spock.
Well, now he is one of the leads. So I guess if you had to pick a lead, it would be Kevin Spacey and Zachary Quinto. Quinto plays kind of an analyst, a former rocket scientist who realizes that his firm's holdings in all of these stocks and bonds are actually not that great. And based on where the market is presently, they could be underwater if the market goes in the wrong direction. And what they realize is that at every firm, that everybody's figuring this out. And at some point, everybody's going to try and start dumping all of their assets. And so when that happens, the first person in will be the one that wins. And so they want to be the first group in to dump all of their assets before the market realizes just how bad the mortgage crisis is.
And Zachary Quinto, of course, just came out a week or two ago. He produces this film. He stars in it. So it's a real personal triumph for him. Directed by J.C. Chandor, who also wrote. But I am definitely hearing a lot of good things about it and want to check it out.
Well worth seeing. It's made $3.5 million, I believe, in theaters and 250,000 plus VOD rentals at the same time. And that's mainly because the film is only playing in 178 theaters, so you can't see it in every market.
Right, that's exactly the type of film where video on demand and availability the same weekend as opening make a lot of sense. It's a small film. It's never going to play 3,000 screens. Why not make it available in the markets where it's not? And if you do, you might as well make it available in New York and LA as well. I mean, you shouldn't black them out. There's no reason to. If they want to pay to see it, let them pay.
And the VOD price was right on. It was $7, $6.99.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's not like it was $9.99 or $10.99 where I think, you know, do I really want to watch this movie? Instead, it was $6.99. It was a no-brainer. I clicked on rent without even pausing.
And Immortals is another film that you could not. It's the type of film that you want to see in a theater. It's a spectacle. Even though it got terrible reviews, everybody agreed it looked cool. I was intrigued by a lot of the reports. I've been seeing this a lot lately. In the press, they say the film costs $75 million after tax rebates.
Well, we could go into this all day long. I mean, but after tax rebates means that they actually shot maybe a $90 million movie, and they probably had to lay out $90 million, but they got a lot of that back when they didn't have to pay taxes, and governments would actually either give them a rebate.
State governments often.
Yes. So they would shoot in Bulgaria or Romania.
Or North Carolina.
Carolina.
They get state tax rebates and stuff and tax breaks. Well, what I'm intrigued is why suddenly it's being reported all the time. The producers are clearly saying it costs $75 million after tax rebates. So they want to look financially responsible, and it made clear this is a much bigger budget movie than $75 million.
Right.
So they sort of want to have their cake and eat it too.
That's right. They want to say, we made a $125 million movie. But they realize what that looks like, not only to Hollywood, but to the rest of the world, which is in a recession. So they kind of say, no, it only cost $75 million because we did it smart. We got all of these rebates and we didn't have to spend all of this upfront money.
But there's $120 million on the screen.
Right, exactly.
Right. So they really, I mean, I don't understand what, you know, the budget's the budget. Whatever it costs, it costs. If it costs you $75 million to make, that's what it costs. You know, you say the caterer gave you a 10% discount. You're going to say, well, the actual budget was 10% higher for the freight catering, but it was, you know, it's goofy. It's like, no, it costs $75 million to make, period.
Right.
After tax rebates is a meaningless phrase.
It's not meaningless in business terms, but, you know, to us, to people that
To what it costs the movie to make and what it's going to need to make in order to show a profit, it's meaningless. I don't care whether you got a tax rebate or the print guy gave you a deal on the 1,000 prints that they struck, or whether you got screwed over by Boston and had to pay a higher amount than you expected. You know, the budget, final budget, what you pay is what you pay.
Well, and you know, I went to the Future of Film Summit last week, which was a conference held by Variety. And I only went to a couple of the conferences or the seminars or panels. However, when I was there, I heard this one panel, the State of the Industry panel, and you had a whole bunch of producers up there saying, and of course, studio executives, and they were all saying the same thing, that there are times where a movie comes in and opens and they're high-fiving on Monday morning. You know, what a great opening they had, even though the media is saying that, you know, the film didn't do very well. And that's because they know, hey, we only spent $25 million on this movie and another $30 to market it. So we're really only in it for $55 with multiples, figure 3 or 4. Movie opened to $20 million with a multiple. We're up to $60 million in theatrical alone. That's pretty good. So what they're saying is, look at profitability. Don't look at a box office opening or box office revenue, because your box office revenue can be $300 million. But if it costs you $500 million to make the movie and market it.
Well, that's what we do every week here.
Right, right. And that's
we're always trying to focus on what the movie actually cost and how much it made, because that's what matters. That's why we don't get excited or upset that Puss in Boots opened. You know, it was the record-breaking Halloween opening, and yet it got downgraded and lost, you know, stock prices.
Because, or DreamWorks Animation, yes.
Bizarrely, it wasn't as big as it should be. And now 3 weeks later, they're saying, oh my God, this movie's a huge hit. It's got great word of mouth. It's doing well overseas. Puss in Boots is going to be a big success.
That's
right. You know, got to look at the long-term big picture.
Now, another group or person who was there was Ryan Kavanaugh. Now, he's the head of Relativity Media. And this was a company that he founded after he, in his 20s, he opened a venture capital firm which kind of crashed and burned. So he wasn't a very successful venture capitalist, but in his 30s, he started to introduce Wall Street to the studios, and he became this co-financier. So he went into Universal and said, look, we will co-finance all of your films. Instead of selling your films territory to territory, so you own it for the US and Canada, but you don't own it in France and Japan, keep it for the entire world, but keep half of it for the entire world. And we, as co-financers, will take the other half. So you're still mitigating your risk. Instead of spending $60 million for a $60 million movie, you're spending $30, and we'll spend the other $30. Immortals is a Relativity Media film, and they...
No, they're moving out on their own now. Now they're saying we're going to finance our movies all on our own.
This was
their first big roll of the dice, where they said, all right, baby. And they said beforehand, we need a $25 million opening to feel good about this movie. We know we're going to be into profitability if we can hit that $25 million opening weekend.
And
which
did.
I say, yes, and it opened $32, but I say, no. You need to look at the final box office. What if it opened at $25 million and collapsed and made $4 million the following weekend? Where would that get you? You know, it's like, no. It'll be a good indicator. But look at the big picture. But they had a good opening. They're heaving a sigh of relief.
That's right. Now, they also opened Limitless. But they had, you know, all of these comedies flop. So they had Take Me Home Tonight and Season of the Witch. And what they did with Universal is they went in and said, look, we'll co-finance 80 films, but you don't get to cherry pick. You don't get to say, well, we know Spider-Man will do well,
right,
so you can't have that one. But this other, you know, one, Wolfman, we're not sure about, so you can have it. They said, we get everything across the board. But, you know, Relativity Media is now kind of facing some financial pressure. As you mentioned, their financial backer wants out, so they're trying to find more money. That other film, Machine Gun Preacher, opened, and it only opened on 30 screens because they had no money to release the film.
And it wasn't going to do well anyway.
Well, that might be why they didn't
waste the money on prints, et cetera. Yeah, basically, if a company is worried about the opening weekend of one film, that's not a company I have a huge amount of faith in. I'm thrilled and happy for them that they had a good opening weekend and they feel like Immortals is going to be successful. But when you're working movie to movie and worried about your survival, that's a sign of a company that doesn't have enough library, enough backing, enough, you know, support to do what they want to do. You know,
right.
Universal can't live or die by one movie. These indie companies, it's always a scraping together your existence sort of thing.
That's very true. You either have to get very lucky very early with some huge hits, or you have to have a lot of financial backing up front to weather the storm in those early years.
Speaking of storms, the Oscars, of course, have faced a huge storm in the last week. All this exciting news happened while we were away. Brett Ratner behaved like a buffoon, made obnoxious comments about gay people. Personally, I felt like he made a great apology, said everything you could want him to say. He met with GLAAD. I mean, he doesn't have a long history in public of saying obnoxious things about gays or other minorities. So I felt like, well, why not give him a pass? However, the Oscars is the gay high holy day of the year, along with the Tonys. So
wait, I thought that was Yom Kippur. That's not. No?
It couldn't be more offensive. You know, it's not like he was producing the CMA Awards. It was the Oscars. So he quit the show, and then everybody thought, "Will Eddie Murphy quit to show support for him?" Yes, he did.
Eddie Murphy, the host. He had been picked to host the Oscars.
Right, Brett Ratner recruited the star of his movie Tower Heist to be the host of the Oscars. People thought it was a good choice. But Eddie Murphy said, hey, you got rid of Brett to show solidarity. I'm going to step aside as well. And as we'd said a couple months ago, Billy Crystal said, gee, I'm kind of interested in hosting the Oscars again. And we thought, well, clearly they're making that phone call. But it turns out, no, they weren't. They were getting Brett Ratner and Eddie Murphy. And now, of course, they've come back full circle and said, Mr. Crystal, you'd like to host the Oscars? Would you mind doing it right now?
And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I'd love to.
Thank you for asking. So Brian Grazer is the new producer of the Oscars. He's worked with Brett Ratner. Brett Ratner gave him his blessing to take over the production
of
the
show. Now, he worked with Brett Ratner on Tower Heist.
Yeah, they produced Tower Heist. And so Brian Grazer, Hollywood insider, big figure. Everybody can calm down. Brian Grazer's in charge. He won't say anything stupid Billy Crystal will be the host. Everybody will feel safe. I loved the online idea of the Muppets hosting. I thought that was
actually amazing.
A great idea.
That was like a Twitter campaign.
Yeah. I liked it. I did whatever you had to do. I thought it was a terrific idea. They probably would want more time to prepare, you know, because you can take like 4 or 6 months to work towards this night. But I thought it's a good idea, and especially with them having the movie out. Hopefully they'll keep it in mind for a year down the road. I thought it was a great, fun, silly idea. Imagine the old guys in the balcony. Oh, this show's so long, I'm falling asleep.
Yeah.
Oh, it could be worse. You could be staying awake. You know,
right,
I mean,
exactly.
Bump, bump. You know, I mean, it had made so much. Animal would introduce the best song stuff, whatever. Thought it was a
the Swedish
idea.
Chef could do a foreign language film.
Oh my God, that's great. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean.
Vinde, 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 vinde. Indigene, you know.
Yeah, it could be great. That's actually hey, look, I thought it would be great. I did wonder, gee, you know, that could be funny for like one bit, but well, I wonder 3 hours of it whether that would work.
Well, you don't make that. It's not a comedy show, and you don't have them doing lots of tape bits, but like you said, the pairing of those people with the categories, and they'll be some adult next to them. It works. Just keep it going. It's not about them putting on a variety show. I don't want Billy Crystal, you know, they always end up doing 20 minutes of filler, making the show longer. But I think the Muppets would be funny just being there, and you just move it along. But there you go.
Yeah, well, you know, you've pretty much covered all the high points. Now, as you said, you know, you didn't think it was a big deal what Brett Ratner said. Apparently the Academy did. I guess really what it boils down to is the Academy tries to outclass Hollywood. You know, there's like a double standard.
Well, that shouldn't be hard.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, he was saying numerous obnoxious things. Some of them were jokes, like this apparently scam or sham thing about Olivia Munn, which wasn't quite true. They were both in on it together, pretending it was true or something. I don't know. I don't care. They don't want the producer of the Oscars getting lots of press. They want the Oscars to get lots of press.
That's right. The producer shouldn't be more pressworthy than the show itself.
Right.
And when you're making crass comments, you know, they realized, hey, we went out on a limb. We went with this guy who was a little kind of not necessarily controversial, but he's a loose cannon. And he proved to be more of a loose cannon than they were willing to deal with.
Exactly. And of course, you want to be careful what you say in public, in interviews, and on Twitter. Because
yes.
What you say will rebound against you.
Now, before we move on to that, because, you know, first off, Ricky Gervais offered to host the Oscars.
He joked about it.
He joked about it.
He didn't really offer. He said, I can do it. I'll do that as well. I'll be in town anyway for the Globes. I could, you know, he cut his fees and I'll do a 2-for-1 offer. I can knock off 20%, 2-for-1 deal. I'll just stay up there.
I think the guy is hilarious. But apparently he's in talks to host the Golden Globes again.
Of course, we said that. It was record ratings. Great ratings. He got tons of attention. It was just the sort of thing that the Globes love. They like controversy because people got to pay attention to them. It was, you know, everybody was, you know, they're thrilled. They'd love to have him back. Then they can joke about how he was controversial the year before. It'll be great.
Well, it's amazing to me, Michael, and you mentioned Twitter there for a second. It's amazing to me how crucial this tool has become and how important it has become. Billy Crystal, when he announced that he was going to be doing the Oscars, he posted on Twitter to his account, "Am doing the Oscars so the young woman in the pharmacy will stop asking my name when I pick up my prescriptions. Looking forward to the show." And now at that point, everybody thought, well, wait a second, is that true? And the way the Academy confirmed it was from their official account, they retweeted his tweet.
There you go.
So it's pretty remarkable. You know, Steve Martin, by the way, hilarious to follow.
Yeah, so is Albert Brooks. I love everything he says.
After the Gaddafi lunch, I just ruined my own punchline. After the Gaddafi news, Steve Martin tweeted, "Gaddafi's people just called and canceled my lunch. Damn."
So you can have a lot of fun with it, especially comedians, but of course you can mess up a little bit because it's in real time, and especially if you do it yourself as opposed to some sort of assistant, you know, tweeting the fact that you're appearing at a public appearance, it can get dangerous, which happened to Ashton Kutcher.
Happened while we were on the phone with one another. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday night. We just happened to be on the phone at the same time, and I mentioned this to you, and it blew up during our conversation. Not because of our conversation, it just...
Right. He's got 8 million. You know, of course not. He's got 8 million followers. So everything he says gets a lot of attention. And he just saw out of the corner of his eye that Joe Paterno had been fired from Penn State as the football coach.
Now, we should explain to foreign listeners, this whole story because apparently
right. Well,
it's
we're
not playing
up the way it happened. All he saw was that the head of Penn State football was being fired. And he tweeted instinctively, he said, how do you fire Joe Pa? Because, you know, he thinks he's a great guy. He says, no class. As a Hawkeye fan, I find it, you know, he thought it was just, you know, bizarre because he's a legend. And he didn't realize that Joe Paterno was involved in this massive scandal involving the rape of a child, multiple sexual molestations of children from an assistant who he'd known for 35 years, had learned about a decade ago. It was reported somewhat to his superiors, but he didn't make sure more was done. And it became this huge steamrolling controversy. It still is. It's a massive, massive case involving many people in Penn State and the state government. It's a very big, serious issue. Apparently, this man is already charged, I believe, with molestation of at least 8 children. More people will probably come forward. A very sad case that Paterno was somewhat aware of, took some action about. But you know what? If you think your best friend raped a child or there's some serious allegation, you tell your boss, my God, I've heard this guy did this terrible thing, and then nothing happens. Guess what? That's not enough.
That's when you go to the police. And that's
right, when you don't see the cops coming in and arrest somebody, you have to act. You're not allowed to say, oh, well, I told my boss, I did my bit. So Kushner got in a little trouble. But
because
you know,
when he said it, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And he immediately got lambasted by Twitter. You don't have 8 million followers and say something like that and then like have nobody respond.
But to me, it was no big deal.
I agree with you.
He immediately said, oh, gee, I didn't realize what the deal was. I apologize. You know, I love Paterno, but clearly I didn't realize what this whole case was about. All I saw was that it was fired. He explained immediately, it's ephemeral. It's gone. It's not a big deal. I didn't feel like he needed to change the whole way he handles Twitter. I thought it was just a perfectly understandable thing.
But he is changing the whole way he handles Twitter because I guess he's been known to kind of do all of his tweeting, if you will.
Yeah, he's actually doing it himself.
Yeah, so he's very authentic about it. He was in a race between himself and CNN Headline News to be the first person on Twitter to have more than 1 million followers. He now has 8 million. And that night, I was reading some of the responses he was giving off to you as I saw them float by on my screen. Right. And he was kind of self-flagellating. He said, you know, look, I had no idea that this was the case. And people would call him an idiot, and he would retweet it and say, you're absolutely right. I am an idiot. I shouldn't have said that.
So I felt like he dealt with it absolutely perfectly well. People make honest, simple mistakes. It was nothing remotely controversial. He just made a mistake, and he accepted it and retweeted their things. I think it was all handled perfectly well, and he could have just moved on.
And he did it in real time. But then on his blog, he said, you know, I have posted virtually every one of my tweets on my own, but clearly the platform has become too big to be managed by a single individual. He went on to say, it seems that today the Twitter has grown into a mass publishing platform where one tweets quickly become news that is broadcast around the world and misinformation becomes volatile fodder for critics. And then he went on to say, a collection of over 8 million followers is not to be taken for granted. I feel responsible to deliver informed opinions and not spread gossip or rumors through my Twitter feed. Which he's never done.
Right.
While I feel that running this feed myself gives me a closer relationship to my friends and fans, I've come to realize that it has grown into more than a fun tool to communicate with people. While I will continue to express myself through @A+K, which is his Twitter handle, I'm going to turn the management of the feed over to my team at Catalyst as a secondary editorial measure. So,
to me, he's posted more than 7,000 tweets. He made one simple mistake that he quickly corrected and corrected in the best and smartest and correct way. I feel like it was no need to change whatsoever, but there you go.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, but there we go. That's moving on to theater news.
Yeah, let's talk about this. I have no idea what any of the theater news is since, you know, it was handed to me moments before we went live.
Well, I saw a couple shows last week. I saw Hugh Jackman, as I said, on Broadway. It was a lot of fun. He's not the second coming, but, you know, more power to him. He was I was very happy to see him. I had a lot of fun at the show. He's a huge success. He's grossing, you know, like $1.2 million a week at the box office. Everybody gave him reviews out the wazoo. And that same day, I saw Venus in Fur, which is a new comedy by David Ives. And it stars Hugh Dancy and Nina Arianda, who just got rave reviews when the show debuted off-Broadway at the Classic Stage Company. And now she's doing it on Broadway. I mean, people are just nuts about it. Woody Allen put her in a movie. They did a Broadway revival of Born Yesterday just to showcase her. And now she's in this show. And this is the first time I've been able to see her live. And she's the real deal. You felt like a star was born. I mean, she just was the whole shebang. The New Yorker had an article about her where they said it was like seeing a young Meryl Streep. It's like hearing Barbara Streisand sing for the first time in the early 60s. It's like, I mean, they just went on and on.
Wait a second. I would ask the person who wrote that, how old are you? And were you around when Barbara Streisand first sang in the 60s?
The Titanic feeling of, wow, we've discovered a new star and a new talent and just the seismic change, you know. I pity anybody who has to handle that sort of rave buildup, but she was great. She was really fun. So it was a fun week. You know, you felt like a star was born officially. She'll definitely get a Tony nomination, if not win. A movie star, Hugh Jackman, is doing better on Broadway than he's done in movies for a decade. I mean, he hasn't made that many good movies. He should be on Broadway all the time. It took 8 years for him to come back after his stint in 2003. Hopefully he'll come back sooner. But that made me look at the charts and see how these two shows were doing and some other shows. And it looks like there's a lot of new shows clogging the theaters. There are other new shows trying to come here in the spring that can't find a house because they're booked up. And looking around, it seems like there's a lot of musicals and that some of the old guard may be about to step down. Now, nobody said anything. Nobody's announced anything.
This is Michael Giltz prognosticating. He's saying that there may be a changing of the guard on Broadway.
That's right.
So you heard it here first.
Right now, Billy Elliot and the Addams Family are closing down in January. And there are a bunch of new shows that probably won't run for long. Chinglish is a comedy by David Henry Hwang. Got bad reviews and it's doing poor box office.
That got horrible reviews.
Sister Act, yeah, I saw it. It's not very good. Sister Act is a new musical on Broadway. It's below 50% of its potential gross and about 70% of capacity. It's not doing great. Follies is doing okay, doing pretty good, but it has to leave its house in order to make way for another show that the theater already committed to. And the expense of moving that show to a new house when it's sort of on the bubble probably means that they'll just shut it down. Hugh Jackman, of course, is doing great, but it's a limited run. It closes after just 10 weeks. The Mountaintop is also doing well. It didn't get great reviews.
But it's only a 16-week run.
But the stars, Samuel L. Jackson and Angela Bassett, are both having a lot of fun. It's doing well, but it's going to close when they leave the show. How to Succeed in Business is losing Daniel Radcliffe. In January, an actor from Glee, Darren Criss, joins the show. And then in February, Joe Jonas of the Jonas Brothers joins the show permanently in that lead role. I don't know if the show's going to be able to handle that switch. We'll have to see. And then there's some other good news shows that are too early to call. Other Desert Cities is a good play. It got great reviews, has a good cast like Stalker Channing and Stacey Keach. The Woody Allen Omnibus with Elaine May and the Coen brother, relatively speaking, got horrible reviews. It's hard to tell yet how it's going to do. Godspell got pretty good reviews, but it's got a very low running cost, so it could be there for a while. Venus and Fur will run as long as Nina wants to stay in it. And Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Wants to what? Wants to star in it.
Long as Nina wants to stay in it, yeah.
Oh, stay in it.
Because, I mean, she'll probably be there for a year or 9 months and then leave, presumably, but then the show will close. And Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, I can't get a handle on. It's very confusing. Right now, it's
kind of like the movie itself.
50% of its potential gross and 66% of capacity. Neither number is great.
No, that is based on the movie, Priscilla,
yes.
Queen. Yeah, right. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And then we have a couple big hits from the last year, Book of Mormon, War Horse, and Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
And Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is a hit despite itself.
Right, and we still don't know if it'll make a profit, and we still don't know how long it'll run, but it seems to be doing well. It's grossed $1.4 million last week. So what we have are a lot of shows and a lot of new shows coming up. Porgy and Bess with Audra McDonald is a big show. Evita was a great UK revival, and it's coming to the U.S. with Ricky Martin. Jesus Christ Superstar played in Canada and got great reviews, and it's directed by Des McAniff, who did Jersey Boys and Tommy. Harry Connick Jr. is coming with On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. There's a new version of Rebecca and a couple other shows. So there's a lot of new shows coming in, including Matthew Broderick in Nice Work If You Can Get It.
Now, have you ever seen Harry Connick Jr. on Broadway?
No, I haven't. I missed him.
I saw him in the Pajama Game, and he was fantastic. Now, of course, he's a performer and a singer by trade, so it's not a huge stretch. But he was really good. He had a huge stage presence.
Well, he's written a few shows like He wrote another show. So he's a real Broadway baby. He's turning into a real fixture on Broadway. He could have stayed on that show, Pajama Game, for a while. It's only because they left that it shut down. If he was there, it would have run longer. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. This is a reworking of a show with a weak book, I should say. It's got an awkward book. They've added a gay element to it. They've added a bunch of new stuff. They've reworked it dramatically, so it's not like the film you might have seen with Barbara Streisand, which isn't very good. It's got some good songs. We'll have to see what's going on. It's a real question mark, but I'm intrigued to see it.
And this is On a Clear Day You Can See Forever.
That's right, and that opens in the spring. So with all this stuff going on, this means that there are a couple long-running shows that are taking hits because there's so many new shows grabbing people's attention, they tend not to go back again and again to see the show they've already seen before.
Well, I wanted to kind of go back to Venus and Fur and Nina Ariadne.
Or Arianda.
Arianda. You see? Sure. I can't pronounce it.
It's a tricky name.
It is a tricky name. Now, when you get that much press, it's kind of like Billy Crystal. I kind of feel like, you know, he's hosted the Oscars 8 other times, and he's got all this press, and everybody's is this huge buildup now to when he actually hosts the show in February or March. I forget exactly when they're airing. But, I mean, it almost is going to be a letdown when he actually takes the stage. So do you feel that for getting all this press, Nina Arianda, I mean, how can she live up to it?
Well, she did. I heard all that press, and then I saw her, and she was good.
Okay.
She was really fun. That was, you know, that was the God help her to have all that. But I was like, you know, you're sitting there with your arms crossed saying, all right, baby, show me. But she was great fun. The show was a little flawed. I didn't like the ending, but she was good. Hugh Dancy was really good, and she just electrified the stage. She was just a really, really good presence. You go, wow, I want to see her again. And I'd seen her on Broadway. I'd seen her on Broadway in Born Yesterday, and she was very good in that. It was a good revival, but she was very good in that. This show, she's just fantastic. So, you know, she's the real deal.
Well, now, speaking of real deals and big whoops.
Oh, no, I haven't finished, though. Very quickly. So that means with all the pressure of these new shows and the new shows coming up, that certain long-running shows are taking a hit. Mamma Mia, I was shocked to see, is really down there. It's below 50% of its potential gross and barely at 65% of its capacity.
But it's been on Broadway since before I was born.
Right, but every show ends. You know, Chicago is in the same position, below 50% gross. It just celebrated, I think, its 15th year on Broadway. These are unbelievably long-running shows. They're playing forever. But at some point, they're going to close. I mean, Cats was billed as now and forever. And even Cats closed, even though it was, of course, the longest running show in Broadway history at one point. So Mamma Mia in Chicago, I'm looking at them and going, wow, you know, I don't know. They might. This is the high point of the season. This is the fall when everybody comes to New York to see a Broadway show. This is a big, big time to make money. And if they're below 50% right now,
they're
come
in trouble.
January, yeah. February, March, the winter, it's going to be rough. So it's something to think about. Mary Poppins, which has also been a really long-running hit, that's also below 50% of its potential gross, below 60% of its capacity. When you walk into a house and you realize that only 60% of the house is full all week long, that's 40% of your seats are not being sold. And Memphis, which won the Broadway Tony for Best Musical, that's also just at about 50% of gross and 75% of capacity. I think that's probably got a little more life in it. None of these have posted a closing notice. None of these are going away anytime soon necessarily. But when they're doing this poorly in the height of the fall season, I think it might be something that within the next 6 months, you might see Chicago or Mamma Mia or Mary Poppins or Memphis saying goodbye to Broadway.
So you're making that prediction now. And I guess we can kind of wait and see if any of that comes true. And when it does, we can hype it up and, you know, get some press for it.
You heard it here first.
That's right. Yeah. We'll put out a press release that, you know, or maybe we should put out the press release now and start the rumors.
Good idea.
That would be kind of a big deal.
Or a big whoop since they say, what does this guy know? And he has no figures to back him up.
That's true. Now, that does bring us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story is Amazon's lending library, in which Amazon Prime customers, like myself, can borrow one book a month from a modest list of thousands of titles from various publishers. Puzzled and confused publishers at first. Now they're talking to attorneys. Apparently, Amazon launched the program without actually consulting with most of the many major publishers included, letting them know what they're doing or getting any approval whatsoever. They insist it's already a valid step based on contracts they signed with publishers. The publishers responded with, what? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's rather bizarre. There seems to be a trend lately in the world of digital. Digital is sort of a Wild West zone, people always feel like. And we've seen music people, we had companies online say, well, screw it. Google says, we're going to go online with this anyway. Or somebody else says, we're going to launch this and we feel like we already have the right to do it. And the people who own the music or stuff say, what? No, you don't. What are you talking about? And then they go into fights about what's in the contracts and what's involved and what they can do. So I'm stunned that Amazon basically seemed to have not consulted with anyone. They did consult with Houghton Mifflin, which declined and then approved a few titles as part of the test. All the other publishers apparently had no idea their titles would be included. So the biggest one of the biggest bookstore chains in the country, just decided to use books in a brand new way and didn't even bother to tell the publishers they were going to do it. It's kind of shocking.
Well, in a way, it's not, because, of course, Amazon did this with music. And as you can see, the record labels and the music industry has not sued either Amazon or Google, both of whom told their customers, you can store your music, the music that you either A, buy from us, or B, have on CD ripped and is your music. So those files you can upload to our cloud storage and our music players.
Because you already own it.
Because you already own it. And when the record companies were up in arms about it. And they have done absolutely nothing, because that's exactly true. What Amazon and Google were saying is true. They are just storing bits of data in the cloud, and customers are allowed to do that, and Amazon and Google are allowed to offer that service to them.
And they had a much better argument, but this is letting somebody who hasn't bought the book read it for free.
Right, but what I guess Amazon is doing is paying for the book outright and saying, okay, somebody's borrowing it. Okay, we're going to pay you, Houghton Mifflin. So here's the $8, $9, $10, whatever it is we owe you for that book. Now they're going to borrow it and keep it for a month, but then they're going to have to give it back. So if they want to buy it, they're going to have to actually shell out money for it. And then at that point, we'll recoup our money. But we're also recouping our money because we're selling lots of Kindles. We're also recouping our money because people are signing up for Amazon Prime, which
is obviously, this is not a long-term business model.
No,
I don't think they would ever. This is just for the test. They would never intend to keep that model in place if they went full term and added on 100,000 titles.
No. But I think you're right, Michael. I think it is the Wild West, if you will. That analogy kind of works. And whenever business models and technology shifts in this type of way, there are companies out there like Amazon who have to lead the way and who have to push the boundaries. And that's exactly what Amazon is doing, because, of course, publishers and record companies and movie studios and television networks, they don't want the model to change. They're kind of happy doing things the way they've always done it. It's been quite profitable for them. However, given technology, the business model and the ground will shift. They're going to have to move with it, and they have to sometimes be dragged, and that's exactly what Amazon is doing.
So it's a big deal.
It's a big deal, yes. You know what else might be a big deal is Jay-Z. The hip-hop star and mogul sported a T-shirt that, instead of saying Occupy Wall Street, boasted the phrase Occupy All Street. Word. In the blink of an eye, he was selling it on his website. But like a true capitalist, this was not an attempt by the multimillionaire to find common cause and raise some funds for the protesters, or indeed any charity. No, Jay-Z was keeping all the profits. Word. And when word leaked out, he pulled the T-shirts and got out of the profiteering on the social movement's business. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but it's kind of hilarious that he would do that. You know, hey, way to go, one percenter, try and capitalize on a social movement.
Word.
It shows he's a real entrepreneur.
Fewer and fewer people are buying New York Magazine on the newsstand. Single issue sales dropped 21% in the first half of 2011. So New York Magazine did the only sensible thing. It raised its cover price. The weekly now costs $6, the same price as the New Yorker. They say readers are finding all the content online, and newsstand sales only account for 4% of circulation. So it really doesn't matter. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big confusion. Nobody buys us anywhere in the newsstand, so what does it matter what our cover price is? Well, if nobody's buying you in the newsstand, why not lower the price to try and get some people to actually buy it on the newsstand? But, you know, my friend has been getting free copies of New York for like years. They just send it to him and they say, hey, you need to renew. He's never paid for it, never asked for it, never wanted it. But they just keep sending it to him so they can, you know, claim that they have circulation higher than it is. But
yeah, that's an old trick.
The cover price has doubled from 2007 to today, from $3 to $6. It's crazy.
And, you know, I love the fact that the government keeps saying, no, inflation is under control. Everything's doubled in price in 3 years or 4 years, but, you know, there is no such thing as inflation. The concert industry titan reported, and this is Live Nation, I assume we're talking about here.
Yep.
They reported an increased profits thanks to higher ticket prices, more online sales, and the like. What they couldn't report is more people actually going to concerts. In fact, according to their third quarter filing, attendance in the U.S. dropped 5%. Presumably compared to the previous year, from 12.8 million concert goers to 12.2 million concert goers that's here in the U.S. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It sounds like with continued poor economy that they've only dropped less than 5%, I think?
Yes.
So that's not a bad deal. It's it seems like concert going's fairly steady, even despite the really tough times that we're living through. So it seems like it's pretty good, you know, pretty good news for them.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering, I saw that their attendance in the U.S. dropped from 12.8 million in 2010 to 12.2 in 2011.
In this quarter.
Q3. And then they said worldwide dropped from 16.4 million or 16.5 million to 15.5 million. And I thought, wait a second, is worldwide, does that include the U.S.?
Well, what it means is Live Nation isn't as big overseas.
That's exactly where I was headed with that statement.
Yeah.
Vanity Fair has a new online film critic and its director, Paul Mazursky. Yes, the man behind Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Now, those are all films. Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice is a film, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills is a film. And his masterpiece, Enemies, a Love Story, is now going to offer his thoughts on everyone else's movies. Mazursky does a bit of work as an actor here and there and has made a few TV movies, but it's been 15 years since he's made a feature film. So if you can't make them, why not review them? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, but I hate this trend. Elvis Costello has an interview chat show on television. Ethan Hawke interviews Kris Kristofferson for Rolling Stone. I need work, people. You're already famous celebrities. Stop taking jobs away from freelancers.
Well, that's the same thing that's happening in the movie industry and in television. All the A-list stars are getting all the B-list roles now. So the B-list stars are getting the C-list roles, and the C-list stars have no place to go.
And Mazursky's first two reviews were not terribly interesting, so hopefully he'll get better.
The company behind the National Enquirer, Star, and the like is launching a new magazine devoted solely to the crazy world of reality television. Called Reality Weekly, it will launch in January with a cover price of $1.79. Now that's a price for a magazine. And the tagline? Less money, more fun. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. I like the low rent price. It fits in right alongside the reality TV stars. But what the heck are they going to put in their other magazines? I mean, National Enquirer and Star and Like are already filled with Snooki and Kardashian news, so it just seems a little repetitive.
Possibly, yes. I mean, you know, I don't watch the television show, so why should I read the magazine? New Yorkers buy more country albums than any other city in the U.S. Hey, with bull riding taking place in Madison Square Garden in a line dance country bar on the East Side, it shouldn't be a total shock that New Yorkers love country music, just like everyone else. In fact, more country albums are sold in New York City than any other city in the country. Of course, New York City is also really big. If you look at sales per capita, Nashville still tops them all, since one out of every five albums sold is a country album, at least in Nashville, as opposed to New York, where only one out of every 20 has a twang to it. And of course, how many illegal albums are downloaded in New York? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. The headline of the article should have been, hey, New York has a really big population.
Yeah, you know, in Los Angeles, which I believe is the second largest consumer of country music, it was a big shock when the only country music station in town switched formats.
Yeah, and New York doesn't have one, which is a shame. I'd be happy to get on and start DJing that.
Okay, I'll let
Clear Channel know, but they don't have DJs.
I was just going to say, yeah, after last week's show. Okay, now the lawsuit against IMDb posting ages on its website is getting really interesting. IMDb claims it has a very good reason, or very good idea, I should say, of the anonymous Texas actress who is suing them for posting accurate information about her age. They say that they believe this woman is the same person who has repeatedly tried to deceive or coerce them into posting false information on their website about her age. They say an actress first claimed her age was inaccurate and sent in a birth certificate with redacted information. Then she tried to get them to change it and post a false birth date. Now they believe this same woman is the one who launched the lawsuit. Who should we get to play her in the movie version of this lawsuit? Someone find me a younger Kirsten Dunst. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. I think the lawsuit's ridiculous. Assuming it has nothing to do with how they obtained the information. The idea that posting accurate information online about a public figure is crazy. It's fascinating to find out if this woman is the same woman who tried to do all this other stuff. But I think it's bizarre. When people are anonymous in lawsuits or not identified in court papers, I thought that was just for the media and that the people actually involved in the lawsuits did know. But IMDb is saying they don't know the name of the person that's suing them. I find that bizarre. Why should they be left in the dark? It's like, you know, that seems weird to me. So I'm a little surprised to hear that that could happen, that they would actually not know the name of the person suing them. I assume they would have to find out by the time they went to trial. Otherwise, it would seem ridiculous.
Actually, they don't. That is one of the things. They are allowed to sue anonymously if being mentioned or being outed publicly.
But you wouldn't be mentioned in court records that weren't sealed. You know, the court records get sealed. That's the whole point. How can you be sued by somebody you don't know? That's weird to me. I understand the court records might be sealed, and so nobody outside would know. And if any documents are released, names would be redacted. But the idea that you could be sued by someone and not know who it is, I find that surreal.
Yeah, well, it's apparently the law. And that's exactly one of the reasons that IMDb is now going to the judge and saying, look, unless this person makes herself known, this lawsuit should be thrown out because it's not damaging her in any way if her name is known.
Or even if it's not, if she's a working actress, she sends out her headshot and her things, her details, she's in movies or TV, and then she's a public figure.
Well, now, speaking of age, some young people cut the cord when they're born and never look back. Some top executives worry that college grads and other young people moving out on their own won't cut the cord with cable or satellite TV because they never buy the services in the first place. Young people are so used to Hulu and Netflix and the like, that paying $100 for cable just doesn't even make any sense to them. Similarly, pay TV channels might be hurting because you could buy HBO for, say, $10 or streaming Netflix for $8, which looks a lot better as a bargain than paying $100 per month. So is the idea that young people simply never buy cable in the first place a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, this article was very content-free. It was an article suggesting that somebody had the idea that possibly this could be happening. There's absolutely no facts. The last time we had something dealing with the idea of people cutting the cord, we found out there was basically no proof of it. That when young people move out of college and do move out on their own, they do find out, hey, you know what? I want to be able to watch sports. I want to be able to watch American Idol. I want to have a DVR. And they actually do buy cable. They need a phone. They need Wi-Fi. They end up getting cable too. There's no proof that this is a big, fat, long-term trend. I re-upped on my cable. I almost cut the cord too, but I couldn't end up doing it. But I thought about it seriously. But you know what? Young people aren't doing this anyway because they leave college and they move back in with their parents.
That's
right.
And
their parents already have cable.
That might be. I think that the reason that this article was written on GigaOM is because
top executive said it. I think it was Dish Satellite Network guy.
Yeah.
But again, show me some proof. But I do like the argument that paid TV channels are hurting because if you're saying, I own cable. Do I want to subscribe for HBO for $10 a month or do I want to pay $8 a month or $9 a month and get Netflix and have access to thousands of shows? You're like, which is the better bargain? If you're going to upgrade
$8 a month for Netflix. Easily.
Right. If you're going to upgrade your TV viewing, you're going to go with Netflix over HBO. I don't have HBO. I used to have it. Haven't had it for years.
Record labels are happy to see that digital music sales continue to rise globally. In 2011, they're estimated to grow 7% to some $6.3 billion. This doesn't make up for the drop in sales of physical CDs, but labels can always hope the modest money coming from streaming services like Pandora and Spotify will continue to grow as well. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Good to see that music sales are still growing digitally. It doesn't matter what format people buy it in. I want to know the total amount spent on music, and that'll give us a better idea of the health of the industry. But since it's the format of the future, we're definitely happy to see it still growing.
Well, I did have a story here about ringtones somewhere that kind of did mention. Oh, okay. So the total ringtones. Well, you know what? We'll get to that during Inside Baseball. How about that?
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. A Roman Catholic nun named Delois? Is that how you
Delois, I say.
Delois. Okay. Good point. Is using Disney.
Disney?
I think she's suing Disney. I'm going to go with suing because, you know, we're all about suing during this podcast, apparently. She says that the film and musical Sister Act are based on her 1992 autobiography, The Harlem Street Nun, which is about, quote, a young black singing nun serving the street people and youths of Harlem. End
Heavens.
Quote. Yes. Delois had taken the project to TriStar, she says, and then producer Scott Rudin took it to Disney. The nun is called Dolores and... Oh, I'm sorry. The nun is named Delois, and the Whoopi Goldberg character, that is called Dolores in the film. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big bizarre. It's how many years later? I mean, what was taking her so long?
Apparently there's no statute of limitations on copyright theft.
That's interesting. But I mean, why did it? The movie was a massive worldwide hit. Why now? There's a couple of bizarre things. New York Magazine calls her Queen Mother, Roman Catholic Nun Delois. Queen Mother. That is That is not a Catholic term for nuns. It's the term for the mother of the queen in England. I don't know why they're calling her Queen Mother. And then they refer to the film Sister Act as, quote, a classic.
Really?
Really, a classic. I don't think so. So filled with factual errors as far as I'm concerned. But De Lois and Dolores is kind of amusing, a little bizarre that they would make it so close, but I'm still puzzled as to what took her so long.
Roger Ebert posted a notice online saying that unless his public TV show, Roger Ebert Presents, can find a major sponsor, it will end after this season. A revival of the Siskel and Ebert format with new hosts, the show airs in 90% of the country, but it's been fully funded by Ebert and his wife Chaz. They need a major sponsor to foot the bill for the show going forward. Fans deluge them with ideas like Kickstarter campaigns and going online where people would pay to watch the show, and Ebert is looking into all of them. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, obviously. There's room, hopefully, on television or the internet for thoughtful, fun interplay of two people talking about the movies. Why not? I'm stunned that he was funding it out of his own pocket this whole time and never dreamed that that was the case. God bless him. I'm not quite sure why he felt the need to do that if you couldn't find somebody to pay for it. You know, never fund your own Broadway show. Never fund your own movie. Never use your own money. That's rule number one. But hopefully he'll have some luck and it's gotten a little traction. And if it's worthwhile, that they'll get some good backers or try something unusual like Kickstarter.
Well, I was really shocked that, you know, all the American Public Television, which is distributing the show, and PBS, nobody's paying a dime for any of this content.
Well, they don't. That's not how they work. They're local stations or local syndicators or local companies create a show, and then it gets carried on those PBS channels. The funding for PBS channels is local programming and the network itself and all that. So, you know, Ebert was careful to add on another note saying he wasn't criticizing them. They do a great job. Your money sent to public television is really well spent. But I'm surprised that he didn't find a particular any channel that wanted to support it, because usually like WNET creates original programming or some other channel.
And then they pay to produce it, right?
Right, yeah, right, or at least some of it, yeah, and gets a big sponsor. But they somehow expected Ebert to get all the sponsors from somewhere else.
Yeah, it's kind of speaking of inside baseball, this is kind of inside baseball a little
bit.
Yes,
it is.
Yes, and actually that moves us along into inside baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week's story really could have been the lead, because EMI has been for sale. EMI, the big record company, for any of those who don't.
One of the big four.
One of the big four. It's EMI, Sony, Universal, and Warner. And, well, not anymore, because EMI has been chopped in half, and half of it is going to Sony, the publishing half, for $2.2 billion. That's how much Sony's going to pay. And the other half, the record label, is going to be sold to Universal for $1.9 billion.
Right. So we've gone now from the top, the big four, to the big three. Record companies are just getting smaller and smaller. There are fewer of them left.
Well, or bigger and bigger when you think about it. In other words, there are fewer of them left. That is true. But there used to be many more.
Well, but there's still a huge amount of small indie labels. I mean, there are artists with their own websites. The amount of the music business controlled by the top record labels, I would be interested to see. You know, there are so many tiny little labels and people making money on, you know, self-distributing, that I'd be intrigued to see exactly how much of the overall music biz, especially if you include concerts and all that, how much the big record labels actually control.
Well, Universal is the largest record music company in the world, and they have a 27% share of the global recorded music market. By adding EMI's record label, they will get an additional 9%. And Sony kind of pushes that 27% level as well. So they're about 25%.
So, and what about Warner Brothers?
Warner Brothers, I don't know.
Right. So if they say they're about 25-27% as well, you're looking at there's probably another 20% controlled by independents, which is probably a record high.
Well, you know, the Impala, the European Independent Music Company Board, they confirmed in a press release last week that they would oppose any attempt by Universal and Sony to buy EMI, even if it was split up. And that is why people are thinking, you know, the insiders, so to speak, are saying that Citibank, which owned EMI, they got them out of default, so to speak. They kind of took over when the loan payments weren't being paid. That's why Citibank wanted to split them, because they didn't want any antitrust regulation to
delayed the deal.
Yeah.
Well, Universal has already confirmed they're going to sell off at least $500 million in assets because they know they can't swallow the company whole that they're taking, the part that they are, the record label. So they've already confirmed they're going to split, you know, sell off at least $500 million, and perhaps they'll get pressured to sell off maybe more. You know?
Right. And Sony's, you know, basically if without Michael Jackson's estate and Sony ATV and David Geffen would not have been able to afford the $2.2 billion. They barely scraped that together.
Right. Sony's the one that bought the publishing side.
That's right.
Which is presumably a lot more profitable long term. That's why it costs more money. You know, Sony bought publishing, which you can make money off of whether people use Pandora or Spotify or stream their music or listen to it on YouTube or a million other ways. Universal bought a record label, which is kind of like buying the horseless carriage, you know? Yay, congratulations, you just bought the Model T Ford.
Well,
you know,
basically, recording is records and CDs and people buying the media.
New music, right. Publishing is the rights, underlying rights to the songs themselves.
Right, so when they're used in a commercial or a movie or a television show, somebody licenses that music.
It's a lot better business to be in right now.
Which is why it costs $2.2 billion to buy the publishing arm and not $1.9.
Right. So what does it mean for people? Well, you know, the whole business has been atomizing. I feel like there's so many more tiny businesses involved that it's not the end of the world. What's the difference between 4 and 3? You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, that's not what Impala says. And the reason I was mentioning that story, and I got this off of Sideline.com or Side-Line.com, is Impala was established in April 2000 to represent independent music companies. 99% of Europe's music companies are small or medium-sized enterprises. So I don't know.
Well, of course, because if I have a label in my home, I'm one company, and Warner Brothers is a second company. So yeah, of course, most of the companies are small.
Okay, well, I didn't know if that statistic was being played or not. You're saying, well, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I would imagine that 20% is probably indie labels. I'd be shocked if it was more than that.
But I bet it grows.
I bet you you're
the one thing I do imagine is that no matter what happens with those companies in 2012, they will release albums on CD.
Okay, now you're talking about yet another story I found on Sideline, which was actually sourcing some study somewhere that said that major labels plan to abandon the CD format by the end of 2012 or even earlier and replace it with downloading and streaming only. I found that hard to believe. I know you don't believe it at all.
Well, when we looked at the article, we saw it was content free.
Yes.
There was not even a single source, not even somebody pretending to say this was the case. Are CDs on the way out? Of course. Do we care ultimately whether somebody buys an album on 8-track or cassette or CD or digital download? No. As long as they're buying music and happy about it, that's great. But yeah, sure, CDs are going to fade down a bit, but people are still buying music on LPs. Very little of it, but you know, the CD format's not going to go away that quickly. It will go away eventually because you know what? There are no stores selling them. I'm in New York City. I literally have trouble finding a store where I can buy an album. I have to go to Best Buy on 44th Street, I think, in Midtown near Grand Central. I have to rush to that Best Buy. It's about the only place I can go to buy a new album. They have a terrible selection, very few choices, but it's the only place I can literally go and pick up a CD. It's that or Walmart or Kmart.
Yeah, that's how many Red Hot Chili Peppers albums or Adam Lambert albums can you really buy?
Right, exactly. I mean, they have a very poor selection, so there's nowhere to go to buy a CD. So, of course, if there are no stores selling CDs, record labels are going to produce fewer and fewer of them. They will fade down. They'll always be around for the foreseeable future in limited editions or special box sets. You know, the money to be made is in publishing and reissues of classic albums. And when you do that, you want like a nice fancy box set with, you know, Pet Sounds with a whole bunch of extras or Smile. The Beach Boys just put out Smile in like a 5-CD box set. So that's right. That's what you see now.
What are you going to give somebody for Christmas? A gift card with, hey, this is actually, you know, Katie Lang's entire collection. You know,
my sister gives her kids iTunes gift cards all the time. But the point is that, you know, CDs aren't going to go away right away.
Right. And it's certainly helping Facebook, because if you're on Facebook and you have some kind of music service like a Spotify or an RDO or a Moog, in the 2 months since the F8 conference, which is Facebook's developer conference, and in the 2 months since Facebook expanded their music using Open Graph, fans have shared listening activity more than 1.5 billion times. And as a result of that, some of Facebook's biggest music developers, like the ones I just mentioned, have more than doubled their active user base. And
well, Facebook is starting to promote these music services, and therefore people are starting to use them.
Right. By 10, you know, their user base has increased up to 10 times.
So when we say something about shared listening activity more than 1.5 billion times, this means like when you say, I'm listening to Adele's album right now.
Right, which happens whether you want to or not half the time, but yes.
Well, not on my system, but.
Right.
But yeah, so when I see something from you saying you're listening to this album or this track, that's what we're talking about.
Yes, and it's actually really, really helped all of these services. Mm-hmm. Cool. And that's probably because when you're talking about all of these services amidst 750 million people, apparently a few of them pay attention. You know, speaking of paying attention and speaking of well, I don't know what you would call this. Van Halen is going to sign with Interscope Records, and Black Sabbath has announced that they will be reuniting with their original lineup and cutting an album and touring.
There you go. These evergreen acts are where you can still make some money. They've got a built-in fan base, and they know when they tour, they can make a lot of money. So, you know, it makes sense for them. It's a lot easier for them to go out on the road than a new act.
Right. Now, do you think of Van Halen with David Lee Roth reuniting with them? You think that act sells?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, no question about it.
But what do they do with all the Sammy Hagar
stuff? They make money
stuff?
With Sammy Hagar. Why wouldn't they make money with David Lee Roth?
Do they sing the Sammy Hagar stuff, or do they just forget that it even existed?
I don't think it really matters. They got plenty to play on. They'll play their new album and, you know, the classics. I don't think he'll need to sing I Can't Drive 55.
Okay. And Ozzy Osbourne returning to Black Sabbath. What do you think?
Well, why not?
Yeah, I mean, and they're going to have a new album produced by Rick Rubin. So,
this is Spinal Tap. I mean, Black Sabbath. Yes.
Yeah, well, okay, just to finish up here, because I mentioned it earlier, our last story in music here during our Inside Baseball segment is all about ringtones, which account for $2.1 billion in music sales annually. That's 34.3% of the music business is due to ringtones. I bet you didn't know that.
Well, that's worldwide or U.S.?
That is worldwide.
Well, there's no way that the worldwide music total is only $6 billion, so that's not accurate.
Oh, so then maybe it is just U.S.
Okay.
Yeah, so then what
I'm
they're
surprised
saying is,
people are still paying for ringtones, yes.
Well, they haven't since 2005. That's really, it's kind of gone backwards since 2005. And now you wanted to know what the share is. In the U.S., I'm assuming, CD sales, $10 billion, and digital
No, this
music
is a projection for the future.
Oh, yeah, sorry, you're right. Gartner projects that.
Anyway, ringtones are still big business worldwide. Who knew?
Download services, $3.6 billion. And subscription services, $532 million. So 8.4% right now.
That's all involved in ringtone business.
No. Subscription services are $532 million. So Spotify and Pandora and Moog and all those things.
Is that for 2010 or what is that for?
That is for the current year. There you have it. Hopefully you know more about the music business than you ever wanted to know. And if you want to know more, you should probably write to us. You can write to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is showbizsandbox. And you can like us on Facebook. Our username on Facebook is showbizsandbox. If you wanted to read any of the stories we talked about on today's show, there are links to them on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those links to email us and follow us on Twitter. And you can also subscribe to us, iTunes, Zune Marketplace, or on Stitcher.com. Those links are on our website too, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, a little programming note, we will not be recording a show next week as it is the Thanksgiving week here in the United States. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. Michael can be found on his website. Where's that, Michael?
MichaelGiltz.com.
So all of his writing and work from all of the various places he publishes stories can be found on MichaelGiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. And until 2 weeks from now, play nice.